Blog Talk Radio.
Jean-Luc, Geordi specs, mysteries on the holodecks, asteroids, triple droids, telepathic betazoids, transporter, deadly claw, visitor from L.A. Law, photons, no Kirk, captain has gone berserk, shuttlecraft, Counselor Troy, Dr. Crusher's little boy, Klingon rights, parasites, new heights, phaser fights, Data's head, Tasha's dead, Riker's hanging by a thread, celebration, transformations, everyone to battle stations.
God, you know, I just love that song more and more every time I hear it. And if you guys have not checked it out on our Facebook page, GM Chris did an excellent job setting that to a video. It's right on our Facebook page. Check it out. He did a phenomenal job. So good evening, everybody. Uncle Jim here with you, and GM Chris. How you doing tonight, Chris?
I'm doing fantastic. Glad to be here with everybody.
As always, here we are Thursday night at 7:30. We have a little bit of bad news. Well, not bad news, but disappointing news. David has taken some time off from the show. He's really busy with warp core breach and the shipyards, and things are going on, so something had to go, and it was Trek Talking. But we're going to keep the captain's seat warm for him, and he's always welcome to come back or call in or join us in chat. So he'll be lurking, and when he gets things back in order, I'm sure he'll be back. So you're stuck with me and GM Chris for a little while anyways. So not that that's a bad
You're stuck with me. Hear us, listeners. Or call in. Either or is really good. Listen to us laugh or call in. I like both. Both are good options.
We can laugh. So I wanted to say a little something here. When I was doing the show with Admiral Kim, we were doing vampires, the Vampire Diaries, horror movies, some science fiction and stuff, when it was the Masters of Disaster. When Ken decided he didn't want to do it anymore, and I took over, and I changed it to Trek Talk, and unfortunately, when we started it, there was no Trek to talk about, per se. Star Trek 2009 had just come out, and In the Darkness, and that was about it. Now we have the 50th anniversary of a new TV series. There's all kinds of stuff going on in the world of Star Trek. So I've decided I'm going to start leaning a lot more on. We're still going to cover things like the Ghostbusters, things of interest to people, because I'm figuring if you're interested in Star Trek, you're probably into the genre, and you're probably a geek to begin with anyway. So when you check out the Facebook page, there's going to be a lot of Star Trek, but I'm also going to continue to cover the topics that I think might be of interest to you as a fan. Also, when I started the show, we were exclusively Star Trek Attack Wing, and we'd have 50, 60 people in the chat room. The phone lines would be lighting up, and that's because at that time we were the only Star Trek Attack Wing place. Now it's all over the place, and a lot of our fans have drifted away to other things and whatnot, and that's fine, because honestly, as much as I love Star Trek Attack Wing, which I do, and we will still continue to talk about it, of course, I am not a gamer per se. I'm a Star Trek fan. Star Trek Attack Wing is part of my love for Star Trek, but not my love for gaming. There is a difference. So we are going to continue to talk about Attack Wing, but not just all Attack Wing. We're going to be talking about Star Trek. So that keep that in mind. Now, for tonight's show, due to the 50th anniversary, they've just remastered Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, the director's cut. It came out on Blu-ray. No, yesterday. Came out on Blu-ray. I have mine on order. We're also going to talk a little bit about Star Trek VI, the director's cut. Where is it on Blu-ray? Well, what's the deal with that? Star Trek Beyond hit with a second trailer, and GM Chris and I are going to talk about that. Do you feel better about the movie after seeing the new trailer, after reading some of the things that Simon Pegg and Justin Lin have said over the past couple of months? There's been some reshoots on the film, but that's normal with big-budget movies. And, of course, we're going to wrap things up with Star Trek, the TV series, 2017. What are our expectations? So we have a pretty busy show for you guys for the next hour or so. If you'd like to call and share your thoughts on any of the topics, 646-668-2433 is the number. We also have a chat room. It's awful lonely in there, so you can bop in there and share your thoughts or give us a call. So, Chris, let's just jump right into Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. In my opinion, probably one of the best Star Trek movies they've ever made to date. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. Wrath of Khan is one of my favorites. Now, I like them all. It's very hard at a glance to put them all in order from best to worst, but from just at a quick glance, Wrath of Khan is typically, if anybody new is starting with the series, that's the one I point them to. It's energetic, it's action-packed, it has dialogue moments, but they're not like drawn out. It actually has meaning and power behind it, makes you think. It's a good place to start for Star Trek fandom.
I like it. I think Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, is looked at by most Star Trek fans as being the pinnacle of the Star Trek franchise for the simple reason that it was a direct continuation of a TV series of the episode Space Seed. They brought back Ricardo Montalban to play that iconic character. They originally were going to recast somebody else, and I'm glad they didn't. I'm glad they went with Ricardo, because anybody else in that role, we might not be talking about what a great movie that was, because they didn't recast Shatner. Why would they recast Khan?
Yeah.
So
he's just
I'm glad they
balance.
Did not do that.
He's a perfect balance of just acting skill and, like, just the strength. Whenever he says a sentence, you can feel the weight of what he's saying, the vengeance behind it, the weight behind it, the meaning behind it. It's just he is a diabolical character, and it's just you don't want to double cross that guy, and he did a really good job playing that role.
And if you remember, if you watched Space Seed, if you remember Space Seed, in Space Seed he was very what's the word I'm looking for? He sat back and he studied what was going on. He played
yeah, he
his
was
steps
very reserved.
Like, yes, he was like a chess master. He
yeah.
always was three steps ahead of where you were. He wasn't laughing and twirling his mustache evilly, but he was plotting in his brain, and he was courteous and kind. But behind all of that, he was like a tiger ready to pounce. When the moment came, he was going to show you no mercy. He was
Did
a great...
He spent like the first half of the episode not playing the chess game, but observing it, watching how everything moved, how everything worked. He got to know how the ship kind of functioned and how the future was and how technology had advanced. He's just merely asking, may I read the schematics on this? I'm just curious about how space travel has, evolved over the last 100 or 200 years, or however long it was. And then all of a sudden, after watching how this game is played of life, he eventually goes, okay, now I'm in charge and you all have to listen to me. Like, he just jumped right in and took control over everything. And it was just a cakewalk for him. So
and
he was just perfect.
What makes the movie so brilliant is because Ricardo Montalban came in and brought that calculating character. I don't know, was it 18, 20 years later, and turned him into a vengeful, hate-filled character. He evolved that character from what he was to what he is in the movies, and as fans, we got to see that change, and he played it brilliantly.
And it and
not
the
only that, but
sense.
We could it did. It made sense, and we got to see, for the first time in Star Trek, that there are more starships than Constitution class. And,
yeah.
Of course, I'm talking about the USS Reliant. when you went to the theater and you saw the Reliant, it was just, it just opened up your eyes to the fact that Starfleet is huge and there's more ships than just the Enterprise, because so many times on the series we only saw the Enterprise. Even in the motion picture, we only saw the Enterprise. We saw the Yorktown and the Hornet, and we saw the Excalibur. We saw other Constitution-class starships on the original series, but they were all the same. They just changed the numbers on the hull. It was the same ship.
Yeah.
Wrath of Khan came along, brand new ship, brand new design, brand new everything, and I think that piqued a lot of interest of a lot of Star Trek fans, and that really, it's like, wow, Starfleet really is huge and has other ships besides this one.
And it looked very similar. Like, the saucer section was practically identical to the refit Constitution, but the nacelles were underslung rather than upright. So it's the same design, but it had a different take. And I think the torpedo launcher was kind of like a spoiler on the back of the saucer or something like that, wasn't it?
That was the torpedo, the weapons pod.
Yeah. So all the components were there. It was just rearranged differently, but it was different. It was like, oh, so there is an engineering team updating these ships and kind of making things new. And so it's not just a whole bunch of like Ford Focuses driving around. There's actually, you know, Chevrolets out there and, you know, such and such.
And I read an article when they were working on the Wrath of Khan that the USS Reliant was the most complicated model that cost them more money to build the Reliant than it did to build the Enterprise. Because the Reliant had to be completely custom built from scratch, and it had to be built specifically to perform what was required of it to do in that movie, whereas the Enterprise is a stock model. The Reliant was not. So I always liked the Reliant. I always thought that was a really, really neat model. I always liked it.
Do you want to hear something really funny? I don't like the Miranda class as much as the Constitution. I don't know what it is about the difference in design. Maybe it's just because I'm full of nostalgia, but I prefer the Constitution class over that. However, this is where it gets weird. I hate the Galaxy class. I think it just looks too streamlined. And I prefer the Nebula class with its underslung. It completely flips in TNG on me. I prefer the Nebula over the Galaxy, but not the Miranda over the Constitution.
Well, my favorite, since we're going off on a little bit of a tangent, my favorite ship, Federation ship that we've seen, I've always been kind of soft on Excelsior.
Me too. That's my favorite.
I've always liked Excelsior, and I always felt that it never got enough love. They never really gave it you what it deserved. But I always liked the Excelsior, especially when Sulu was in command of it in Star Trek VI.
Yes.
I just kind of, you know, my ship, that's my guy.
I loved it in Star Trek VI, where the Enterprise is getting beamed on by torpedoes from a Klingon ship. And then Chang fires a torpedo, and it just bounces off the Excelsior class. It doesn't go through its shields. Like, even the first few volleys of torpedoes were just penetrating the shields of the Enterprise and hitting the hull. And then the Excelsior class comes in, torpedo hits it, and it just bounces off the underside of the saucer. Like, whatevs. It's like an armored knight just walking onto the battlefield in full plate armor. Like, you know, you got nothing on me.
Yeah, Chang was kind of crazy to take on the Enterprise and the Excelsior.
He did have the upper hand for a while, to be fair. He was cloaked and unable to be found, so unless they both started just firing volleys of phasers everywhere and just like in Star Trek Nemesis, where the Enterprise E just fired volleys everywhere, just hoping to hit something, he really had the upper hand until they figured out, you know, it must have a tailpipe.
Which, well, we'll talk about that some other time, anyways, back to Star Trek II. For the 50th anniversary, Paramount did release the remastered director's cut. Now, what is a director's cut? Well, first of all, they cleaned it up. It's sharper, it's cleaner, the audio is better. But most importantly, which a lot of Star Trek fans already know, I'm sure you've seen the DVD, the two scenes, there are let me see, there's 4 minutes, three or four minutes of extra scenes that are put back into the movie in the director's cut. Well, we'll talk about a different version in a minute, but the director's cut. And those two scenes are Scotty and his nephew. They're at
really?
Why they cut them out in the first place? I don't know. Who was sitting in the editing room and said, "Oh, cut that 2 minutes out. Oh, cut that minute out. Okay, we got a good movie here." Why they decided to do that, I'll never know. But they put those two scenes back in with Scotty and his nephew, which I think is great because it fleshes out Scotty's character, you know, as well. So those two scenes are the biggest additions. Are with Kirk and Scotty's nephew and Scotty and his nephew. I think they're both scenes together are maybe 3 minutes. That's about it. That's the director's cut. But those three scenes are 3 minutes are awesome. You never get enough Star Trek. Now, the addition that I would like to see, the version that I wish they would release, is when the Wrath of Khan came out on TV, ABC got their hands on a television cut of the movie, which had the extra scenes from the director's cut, but it also contained alternate scenes of different takes, different camera angles, and a couple of different battle sequences in the nebula. And like there's one scene in particular where Kirk tells Chekov to fire the phasers. You know, he says fire, and you see Mr. Chekov, or you see Chekov push the button to fire the photon torpedoes. But when they cut to the exterior shot, it's a phaser strike, and that always bugged me, because in the ABC television version, that battle in the nebula is a little bit longer. There's a few more exchanges in there that were removed for pacing or whatever reason. I don't know. There's alternate versions of scenes that are still in the movie, but they use a different camera angle or a different take, or it's tighter on their faces, or it's a long shot where you get to see all of them instead of just one of them. It's a slightly different version of the movie, but I think it's a far superior version. I like it much better. I have it on videotape. I taped it off the TV way back in 1983, and I have the videotape. I'm just waiting patiently for Paramount to dig into their archives and put this on DVD. I'm going to have to settle for the director's cut for now. But have you seen the director's cut, Chris?
No, I haven't. I have the set on DVD that came in the big clunky gray boxes. That's the set that I got. I don't think that's the director's cut or not.
Well, I should have mine in the mail tomorrow. I'm hoping. But not only that, the Wrath of Khan, one of the other things that makes the Wrath of Khan such a fan favorite, I think, is because, first of all, we get to see Carol Marcus. She's not actually mentioned by name, but there is an episode of the original series where McCoy refers to the little blonde lab technician and that Kirk had hooked up with, which, of course, is Carol Marcus. They didn't say that by name, but she's referred to in an episode of Star Trek, and then 20 years later, we get to see the character. And, of course, David, Kirk's son, we get to meet. And Space Lab Regular One, which basically is, if you remember the motion picture, they just flipped the space station upside down or right side up, whichever you want to call it. But it worked. It worked. Now, as far as the movie goes, there's a deleted scene that I posted on our Facebook page. You guys can go and check it out. Savick. Well, let's talk about Savick a little bit. They missed the boat big time with David and Savick when they made Star Trek III: The Search for Spock. not only did they kill off David, they wrote themselves into a corner. They killed off, they're not going to kill off Spock because they're searching for Spock. So they can't kill him. I feel they should have killed off Savick because the way they ended the way they left the character of Savick in Star Trek IV was a total waste. Why did they save her over David if they were going to leave her behind on Vulcan in the very next movie and never come back to her character again?
Yeah.
The reason why I mention that is because Savick, there's a scene in Star Trek II. You know when Kirk gets the book from Spock for his birthday?
Yep.
And they're walking through Starfleet Command, and there's a janitor there cleaning the floors, and he looks at the title, and he says, to Spock, a message, perhaps? And he says, no, just a gift. That right there, when they're walking down the road, the hallway, right before that dialogue exchange between them, when he says to Spock, I suppose you're milling around to find out what score I gave your cadets, okay? And Kirk says, well, they destroyed the simulator. You know that scene I'm talking about?
Yep.
Right after he says that, as they're walking along, Spock says to Kirk that Savick is very volatile. She's more volatile than you or me because she's half Romulan.
Oh.
And they cut that out. Now, if you there's a video on our Facebook page, you can check that out and see that reconstructed scene where that line is removed. But I think had they left that line in there, and had we known what they were going to do in the future of Star Trek, you know, they had a lot of things they could have done with the character of Savick, and they dropped the ball. They just dropped it big time. Of course, Savick and David, it's hinted at that Savick and David kind of together, and that Savick may have actually been carrying David's child in Star Trek IV, and that's why she stayed behind on Vulcan. We don't know. It's also hinted at that she actually went through the Pomfar with Spock, and she could have been carrying Spock's child.
Yeah.
Either way, we'll never know because they left the character behind and never got back to her, never gave her what she deserved for being such a great character in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
That makes a little bit more sense now for number six, where she just out of nowhere orchestrates kind of a battle between, you know, they're trying to orchestrate the peace treaty with the Federation and the Klingons, and she kind of makes this whole Enterprise firing off at the Klingons plot device. And if you knew she was half Romulan, it would make a bit more sense that she would fight back with passion rather than logic. And a scene always kind of bugged me a bit where it's like, where's the Vulcan logic in trying to reignite an entire war? Like, what was the thought process behind that?
Yeah, they could have gone in a better direction, but there's also, so I learned something new. Yes, the guru learned something new. Apparently, Marlo Moreau, Khan's Starfleet wife that helped him escape in the space seed, who we do not see in The Wrath of Khan, she's dead when they find the Botany Bay. Apparently, she had a baby, and there's a scene where Chekov and Captain Terrell find the Botany Bay, and you can see the child in one of the windows looking out at them. And when they get into the ship, the child scurries away. And then later on, Khan takes the child with him onto the Reliant. And when he detonates the Genesis device, there's actually a scene where the child is crawling towards the blue lights on the Genesis device on the transporter pad. And those scenes were cut out of the movie. but you can read about them and see the only existing photograph of this child on the Genesis pad on our Facebook page. So check that out. I did not know that.
No, not that I did not know either.
So you learn something new every day.
The world
so
of Star
Trek,
Trek 2,
it's ever-growing. So Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan, on Blu-ray, director's cut yesterday. There's a whole article on it on the Facebook page. You can read all about how they improved it, how they cleaned it up, you know, blah, 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 blah. Suffice to say, if you're a Star Trek fan, this is the version you got to pick up. It does contain both versions, by the way. The 116-minute version and the 112-minute version are both included, as well as a new 30-minute documentary called Creating the Genesis Wave, which hasn't been released anywhere else. All the other extras that are on this DVD, are on this Blu-ray, are the same ones that were released for the 25th anniversary DVD, so bear that in mind. But I still bought it, and I recommend it. So that brings us to my next thing, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. Now, when I went to see this in the movies way, way, way back in 1991, we loved the movie. When it came out on DVD and VHS, yes, yes, you heard me right, VHS, because VHS wasn't quite dead at that point in time. And we went home and watched the DVD. We were totally shocked to find out that there were extra scenes in this DVD that we did not see in the movie, which really just helped to enhance the movie. One of the extra scenes is when they're talking about how to rescue Kirk and McCoy from Rapente, and Admiral Odo there is giving his presentation to the Federation Council. The Romulans are there, and you see it in the trailer when he says, "There will never be a better time," and you're like, well, that scene's not even in the movie. Well, it was, but they cut it. And there's that whole sequence, which is on the DVD, but not in the movie. Another big sequence, which they removed, is the scene where Spock and Kirk, or Spock and Scotty, are having a conversation about the missing photon torpedoes. And all of a sudden, Valkyris comes sliding down this pole and tells them that Gorkon is dead. And Scotty says, well, the Klingon bitch probably killed her father. She didn't shed a tear. And Spock says, highly deductive since Klingons don't have tear ducts. That scene was not in the movie, but it is on the DVD. And perhaps the biggest scene of all that bugged the hell out of all of us Trekkies when we saw the movie originally is when Scotty shoots the Klingon and he falls through the window and he hits the ground. They show an above shot of the Klingon laying there, and there's a big pool of red blood behind his head. And they went out of their way at the beginning of the movie to show you that Klingon blood looks like Pepto-Bismol. It's bright pink.
Yep.
And then they get to the end and they make this mistake and have red blood all over the guy. Big, 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 big foobar. And every Trekkie fan that saw that movie noticed that and said, why the hell did they do that? They went out of their way to make it pink and then made it red? What the hell? They didn't actually make a mistake. They didn't. There's a scene that was cut out of the movie but put back in the DVD where, I don't remember who it was, Spock, somebody reaches down. Worf says, this is not Klingon blood, and pulls off the mask, and it's a rubber mask on Colonel West. He was the assassin. Well, those three scenes were not in the movie, but they were on the DVD when it came out. The crappy Blu-ray that's out right now is the theatrical version without those three scenes. It's terrible.
No way.
It's terrible. It's terrible. I won't even watch it. It bugs me that much. It bothers me tremendously. A great movie. Love the movie. But it always bugged the hell out of me when they went to all that trouble to make Klingon blood pink, and here's a puddle of red blood, and they just cut that scene out. Why, Chris? Tell me why.
I have no idea. I have the DVDs, and that's the only scene I've ever known is where the mask comes off. And, oh, that's Colonel Weiss, and that's all I've ever known. I didn't know they cut that out. Why would they?
Yes.
It's only like 12 seconds.
If you buy the Blu-ray, if you pick up the Blu-ray set and watch it, it says on their original theatrical version, and that scene is not there.
Why?
Yes. I wasn't sure if you knew this or not, which is why I wanted to bring it up on the show, because a lot of people might not know that.
I'd be grumptastic. Well, now I am. So it's like the scene was completed. So why remove the 10 seconds? Like, you know, you get Lord of the Rings that's 3 hours long. 10 seconds isn't going to kill you. I know it's two different, you know, decades when they were made, but still, like, 10 seconds. Like, really?
Exactly. Who was sitting around editing this movie and said, you know what? Let's cut out that, this is not Klingon blood, where he pulls off the mat. Let's cut that out. The Scooby-Doo ending, let's get rid of it. And everyone said, okay, good idea. And they cut
this
it out.
Totally
and then
redundant.
Later on, when they put it back on DVD, they said, oh, wait a minute. We messed that up. We got to put that scene back in. Why? Why? I'm waiting for the DVD version to come out in Blu-ray, the complete version of Star Trek VI that has that scene and the other two that I talked about. I'm patiently waiting. Because it changes the movie.
It really does. Now I won't be able to unsee that.
That sequence at the end changes the entire movie, because the way it ends now, the way it was in the movies, you were led to believe that the Klingons were the ones that were conspiring to kill the Chancellor and overthrow the Federation, and that's the way the movie ends. However, with that 10-second clip, at that point, you know, it wasn't the Klingons at all. It was the Federation and the Romulans. Well, and Chang, of course, but it changes the whole political message of the movie, that one sequence. So, yeah, I don't know when we're going to see that on Blu-ray, but I want it.
Have.
I need it.
It's only logical.
It is. It is only logical.
The logic returned when they put that scene back in.
Yeah, why? I mean, why? That's all I got to say is why.
So in the offices of Paramount, as I'm going to make probably everybody grumpy by saying this, but it's going to be hilarious. So when that scene was removed and everybody was complaining about it, did a Paramount executive slowly sit down in a chair and say, I hear the sound of a million wailing fans crying out in anger?
I swear to God, back in 1991, when we all went to see it, after the movie, when we all got together at Ground Round and had burgers and fries and were talking about the movie, the one scene that we all went to and picked the shit out of was that one, because we never knew Klingons had pink blood. In fact, I don't think we've ever seen pink blood on Klingons ever, except in Star Trek VI.
Yep.
And they went through all this trouble to make sure that we knew Klingon blood was pink. And then they get to the end and they totally screw it up and make it red. What the hell? And that's why, because that scene was not in the original movie. So,
that's crazy.
Two things tonight.
And I'm always happy to learn Star Trek things, even though they removed the pink blood. Blah, blah, blah. But still, it's great to learn things.
Yes, you learned two things tonight about Star Trek, Star Trek II and Star Trek VI. But still, even though it's still an excellent movie. And oddly enough, Nicholas Meyers wrote and directed Star Trek VI along with Leonard Nimoy. And why would I bring up Nicholas Meyer's name?
Is it because he's helping out with the latest CBS TV series?
Exactly. That's a good catch. That's exactly why. There's an article on the Facebook page, CBS/Paramount, Paramount/CBS, however way you want to go, is adding to their writing and creative staff. And not only do they have Nicholas Meyers, which is huge because he did Star Trek 2, 4, and 6, which are revered by many Trekkies as the holy grail of Star Trek movies, but they're adding more and more talent to their list. And I should have looked it up and got their names, but they've added some of the writers from Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Star Trek Voyager to the staff of Star Trek 2017. So the list of talent that's going to be involved in creating this series continues to grow and become more and more interesting. We still have a ways to wait, but it's still becoming more and more interesting as we get closer.
Now, I'm eager to see it.
I read two articles, and we'll talk about them both. The first one I read is that it's going to take place after Star Trek VI, like around dealing with the Klingons and what happened after Star Trek VI. And I think that's a great place to jump in because that
yes.
puts us Enterprise B-ish. So
yep.
that's good.
And it's about 70 years before TNG takes off. So the Ambassador class is not even built yet, might not even be a pipe dream yet, because the Excelsior class is just booting up as a production model. So it's new, but it's still the same Trekverse that we know and love.
Right. Exactly. I think that's a great, and I also, the other thing that I had read, and Ken and I had touched on it when I did my 50th birthday special show that I did all about me for me, because I can do that, so I did it. One of the things that we talked about a little bit was I had read an article, and this is going to throw a lot of Star Trek fans off, but I don't care. If you don't like it, call up and yell at me. Okay, 646-668-2433. That the new series, there was a stipulation. The reason why we're not seeing the new series until next year is because CBS Paramount had this agreement that the new movie, Star Trek Beyond, had to be released prior to the new series being aired. There had to be a six-month window between the two. And that struck me as strange. A lot of people were like, well, it's J.J., well, it's the conspiracy, well, blah, 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 blah. However, I read an article that said CBS and Paramount, or whatever the entity is these days, doesn't hold the rights to produce new Star Trek using the old copyrights. And this kind of ties into the Axanar situation a little bit too. They have the rights to produce everything that was created in the JJ verse and beyond, and nothing that doesn't. And therefore, the original universe is now dead. It's now closed. The book is closed on it. End of story. Everything that we see from now on will all take place in the JJ verse, because that's the world that they own and that they're free to roam in without having to pay anybody any rights. Therefore, the new series will take place after the events of Star Trek VI, but in the JJ verse. And not in the original verse. Now, what do you think about that, Chris? How does that make you feel? And then I'll share my thoughts.
I'm okay with that. We haven't had new Star Trek in about a decade now, and I'm just happy that we have anything coming on the airwaves. And for me, it's not so much the universe as it is the actors that portray in it, and if it's good story writing, and if I can get immersed in that story, that's what matters. The biggest fallback for Enterprise for me was the actors were all great. I can't complain about them. There might have been a few moments here and there where I go, that doesn't work out that great, but for the most part, I liked that crew. It was just the universe that they were in felt really, really wooden and bland, and I couldn't get into it. And I love Voyager. I love the characters in Voyager. I love the story arc of it. It's a bit of a gruff start, in my opinion, but as it goes on, it gets more and more solid. And that's why I can still watch TOS, is just the characters are great, the universe is great, and even coming, it's made in the 60s, so special effects are very, very subpar by today's standards, but it's still immersive. I still get wrapped up in the storylines. Like, I still love Doomsday. That's one of my favorite episodes of the TOS. So for me, I'm not too worried about what it's about. It's more of how it's made, the quality of it. I'm more intrigued of that.
Well, I think for myself, I know a lot of Star Trek fans are very rigid, and they're not gonna bend, and that's fine. That's fine. But by shifting it out of the original universe and into the new universe, this opens up an entire plethora of new ideas, new things, new civilizations, new aliens. They're not bound by what's happened over the past 50 years. So when they sit down to create this new show, they can look at the events of Star Trek VI and say, well, what if this happened? And what if that happened? And they don't have to stick to anything that's already been predetermined, because they're in an alternate universe. So they're free to explore things that they wouldn't have been free to explore had they stayed in the prime universe. And I think that's great.
You don't even know if the Klingons and Federation are allies in that new universe. Like, by the end of six, it worked out apparently, because by TNG, they're all happy-go-lucky as one big unity, but you don't know in this universe. You can't, the term for tabletop gaming, where you've read all the rule books inside and out, and for Dungeons and Dragons, a zombie appears, and you know its stats off by heart, right? Like, you know exactly what you need to do, you know what his weaknesses are. We call it metagaming. So what I'm getting to here is, with the J.J. Abrams verse taking place the way it is, you can't metagame the story arc. If you see Klingons, you don't know if they're friendly or not until the show states that they are. You can't use previous knowledge outside of, in the Prime universe. This is entirely new. They can do whatever they want, and they're correct.
And that's what I love about it. That's exactly what I love about the fact that they're going into, that they're using the JJ verse. We don't know anything about it, and we get to experience it and learn it all over again. And
yep,
I think
exactly.
That's great. I really think that's great. Now,
you can't metagame this, and that's what I like about it. Well, that is going to be a plus one for me. It's not a victory yet. We have to see how they execute this, because if they make the Klingons like riding around on purple unicorns, I might walk. But we'll see. Like, it's a plus one for me. It's in favor of the flavor of Star Trek for me.
And I want to mention something. We're gonna talk about this next, but I want to come back to the fact that they made a specific point of throwing the Klingons into the first Star Trek movie and mentioning them in the second movie. And they had to have something in mind when they did that. So perhaps we'll see that in the new series. But for Star Trek Beyond, by using the JJ verse, when you saw the trailer, and we're going to talk, I don't want to talk about this right now, but we're going to come back to it. When you saw the trailer and you saw Krall, the new bad guy, what do you know about him? Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. We don't know his race. We don't know, are they are they assimilate? Are they warriors? Are they wizards? We know nothing at all about them. And to go into a Star Trek movie completely blind after 50 years is something that really excites me, and I'm really looking forward to that. So we'll come back to that in a minute. But the other thing that I had heard about the new Star Trek series is, and then Ken and I had talked about this a little bit on my birthday show last week, I had read that they were going to do an anthology. And as much as that idea intrigues me, and it does, I think that it would have to be done in the right way to work on for Star Trek.
Yeah.
Well, let me explain. I want to use the Game of Thrones as an example. If they had a multi-arc story, like on the Game of Thrones, where you have the Dragon Lady and you have the midget dude and you have the Starks, if we had different starships, different crews on different ships in different parts of the galaxy that were all involved in different missions that were leading eventually to culminate with one goal in mind, then I think an anthology on Star Trek might work. But if they just turn around and make season one be about the USS Excelsior, and then when season two ends, it's over, and then season two starts and it's on the USS Montgomery, and then season two ends and season three starts and it's on the USS Lollipop, I don't think that would work. I don't think the Star Trek fans would follow it if they had a different ship and a different crew in every season.
You would need,
but if they had a different ship and a different crew, if they had a different ship and a different crew, you know, every third episode, for instance, and they may not know it, but we would know it as fans, that they were all leaning towards one thing, kind of Game of Thronesy type, then that might work.
Yeah, that would work really well.
If they were to do something like that. Where they had three different crews, three different ships, they're all in different things, doing different things, but they're all actually working on the same mission. They just don't know it, but we do as fans, and culminate with a big bra-dee-da with the Borg or whatever. That might work.
Yeah, I would enjoy that.
We'd have to wait and see.
The biggest thing with Star Trek for me is it's the crew. It's almost like a family that you come to know and love. And it takes time. It always takes time to warm up to these characters. I hated TNG for the longest time, and I still kind of dislike it. It's not my favorite, but it took time to warm up to these characters. Deep Space Nine, I thought, was just rubbish, because I'm like, what kind of adventures can you have on a space station? So I threw it aside. But I like Sisko. I like Quark. I like Odo. That's a very good cast, but it took me time to warm up to them. And same with Voyager. I saw seasons one and two, and I'm like, oh my God, why does everybody have a stick up their butt? Like, really? What the hell happened to Starfleet? And then by episode five, I'm like, do they make it home? Please, please tell me they make it home. I love that holographic doctor. And Neelix, I would love to, just chum around with, one night at a bar or something like that, and just hear fantastic stories. So having it break up quickly, even in one season, it might not be fast enough for fans to fall in love with the crews the same way as the other series did. And like you said, it might be better if they do it as a culmination of several story arcs, where you see an episode here, an episode there, an episode here. You're following a Klingon Cavort, you're following an Excelsior class, and you're following a the Romulans wouldn't have a Dedarigex, so whatever the US the Pi was, the science vessel, or you'd have these story arcs. It might throw you off at the beginning, going, okay, what the hell is happening? Why am I watching this now? Why am I watching that one? Why am I here now? But as the season goes on, if it's done right, you'll get used to it. And if it's done over three seasons, it would give you the time to fall in love with at least one of the arcs, if not all of them. And, yeah, I don't know. If they keep flip-flopping, I don't know how well that's going to work out, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't know. I know a lot of fans like the way Deep Space Nine was laid out. A lot of fans like that. Because Deep Space Nine, they actually did things in chronological order, whereas TNG and TOS, they went on a mission. Well, okay, when did they meet the Tribbles? Was that before or after Balance of Terror, or does it really not matter?
Yeah.
They're really not. The episodes aren't really tied together. You can watch them in any order. It doesn't really matter. Whereas Deep Space Nine, like around the, I want to say, fourth season on, maybe, they started going, and the missions were chronologically organized on the series, where they actually, what happened in one affected what happened in the other, and they actually went places that they said they were going, which is something that we never saw in Star Trek before. You know, like, you know, Sisko would take off in a ship to go to Ferenginar, and two episodes later, he's there. You know, and stuff happens along the way. People
yeah.
seem to really like that approach. So, if they do a new series and like that, I think a lot of fans might like that. You know, it's more. And you know, something else that came up is the word canon. What is canon, and what exactly does canon mean? And the fact that this is all make-believe, does canon even matter at all? And in my opinion, I've got to say that, yes, canon is very important, and it
yep.
does matter.
It's all about the continuity.
Right. If you've already, when you step into any world, it can be Star Trek, it can be Star Wars, it doesn't matter what world you're immersing yourself in. It could be the Black Hole, it could be Logan's Run, it could be Alien, Predator, it doesn't matter. Whatever world it is that you're immersing yourself into has rules in that world. Okay? And those rules are interpreted as canon. You can't establish rules in a universe and continuously break them and expect fans to pay attention and watch it and take it seriously.
Yeah.
You have to stick to the canon that you've established in your world. Now, yes, I know it's make-believe. Yes, I know Klingons aren't real. I do have a life. But when you're stepping into a Star Trek movie, you have to believe that what you're watching is plausible. If they break their own rules, that plausibility goes right out the window.
Yep.
Now, I'm not talking about like expanded universe canon, like when Disney bought Star Wars and they threw away 30 years of history and said, "Look, we're throwing this all out. This doesn't count anymore. It's not considered canon." And that really ticked off a lot of Star Wars fans, but Disney kind of had no choice because they're planning on releasing all these new movies and all these new anthologies, and they can't be bound by what has been done previously. So they had to do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no point in making a movie about Yoda if you already know everything there is to know about Yoda. And I think that's kind of the direction that Paramount is going with the JJ verse versus the Prime Universe. There's only so much you can do with a universe that you're so familiar with before it becomes boring and predictable, and you have to shake things up. And Disney said, okay, we're throwing everything out and we're starting all over again from right here with The Force Awakens. This is what we're starting with. Nothing before that, except for the movies, is canon. And for me, I'm like, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that at all. And I think Paramount's doing the same thing with this new series, and I think that's the right move.
Yep.
I mean,
because honestly,
we'll have
to
wait and see.
At this stage in the game, you can call upon any episode to undermine the current episode that you're watching, right? Like, I remember watching on Enterprise when they had magnetic hull plating. And I saw all the things on the internet that kept popping up of Scotty yelling at Kirk going, where the hell is our magnetic hull plating? Where did that go? Like, and it's just, it starts to break down once you start packing on more and more story to it. And if you can't keep it straight, you know, and that is kind of, you know, breaking for a show. So having it take place in a fresh universe where you're like, oh yeah, all the other stuff did happen. It's just on another tangent. So you can technically and theoretically call back upon it for reference. You know what Klingons are. You know what humans are. You know what Romulans are. You don't need us to explain in great detail what they are unless we change the rules, which works because we're in an alternate timeline. So unless we state otherwise, you already know. And you can carry on from there without worrying about breaking your own continuity or canon along the way.
Exactly, because, like, for instance, you're on the game table, and a Borg cube drops out of warp right in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, you already know you need to turn tail and get the hell out of there. You know this already. We saw the Borg cube carve up the Enterprise D. You know you don't stand a chance. You need to get the hell out. Unless you've got some other way to deal with them, you already know you're in trouble.
Yep. And outrunning them half the time isn't even an option. So you need to outwit them to get anywhere.
Right. Because we already know what the Borg are about, what they do, what their capabilities are. But if you're there and all of a sudden a Krall diamond shows up, you're like, what?
Yeah.
Now you don't know.
Yep.
You don't know. And that, I think that by moving this into the JJ verse and changing all those rules on us only helps to enhance it. At least it does for me. You know, because we don't know everything there is to know about all these characters. We don't know all the nuances. We don't know the Klingons. We don't know this Krull guy from Star Trek Beyond. There's so much we don't know. So I think that's a good idea.
Oh, I totally like it.
So this brings us back to the final topic I wanted to talk about, and that was the new trailer for Star Trek Beyond. Now, have you had a chance to see it yet?
Yes, I saw the new, because we have that ongoing friendly bet with the movies of the year, TMNT was one of my choices, so I funded the cause and went and saw it, and of course the new Star Trek trailer was right at the beginning of it.
Yeah, I got to see that and the Star Wars trailer. I was pretty excited about that.
Oh, I saw that earlier
in the movie.
I can't wait. I am looking forward to Star Wars far more than Beyond, unfortunately. I should be happy that there's both. I should be really happy that there's both. But Rogue One is making me cry tears of joy because Jan Ors is in it, and I can only assume Kyle Katarn's in it. I can only assume. But I know Jan Ors is in it, which means my childhood's canon is now official with Dark Forces. You know, my first immersion to Star Wars was that video game. I never watched the movies until later. So that makes me happy. But Beyond, I guess now we're going to discuss it on why I went, when I saw the trailer in the theater.
Well, let's talk about it.
Let's jump right on in. So
I tell you, I saw the trailer, and I was like, wow, this really looks different than what they've done before. I really like the fact that we saw more dialogue between. Well, I've always been a McCoy guy, and I like Carl Urban. The dialogue we saw in the first trailer with him and Spock just made me chuckle. when he says, well, at least I won't die alone, and then Spock beams away, and McCoy says, how typical. That was typical McCoy to me, and I got a chuckle out of that. But then seeing the new trailer where Kirk's on his having his birthday, and he's questioning whether or not he's got what it takes to be the captain and whatnot, and McCoy...
He's doing it for the right reasons.
Yes, they show him and McCoy having this talk, and it reminded me of the conversation that McCoy has with Kirk in Star Trek III. Or in Star Trek II, I'm sorry, when he comes and asks, you know, why did you leave him there, blah, 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 blah. And McCoy is talking to him about becoming a part of this collection and whatnot. It always seems that McCoy is the one that has to talk to Kirk. And seeing that, and he's talked to Kirk several times about things like that on the original series as well. So to see a scene like that in the movie, I was like, wow, this is nice to see. So I liked that. I thought that was nice. And to see the Yorktown Starbase, I was like, holy Christ, look at this. It's like 100 Deep Space Nines. I mean, this thing is huge. It's like a Dyson sphere all of its own. It's like, you know, this is where the Federation... The new members of the Federation go to learn what it's like to be part of a Federation, I think is the way they described it. And I'm like, that's interesting. I hope we get to see some more members of the Federation besides just a bunch of humans. Let's see a Horda, maybe, or a Gorn or something. I don't know. But that would be interesting. And, you know, the new starship, the Larson, is interesting as well. I don't know how they're going to work that into the story, but that looked interesting. And of course, the Enterprise getting destroyed by flying things.
Yeah.
We don't know anything about this, which is good because we don't know by these swarm of things. And then, you know, I had read an interview that the Enterprise gets destroyed in the beginning of the movie, and that leads to bigger and better things later. I'm hoping we get to see the Enterprise class with the square nacelles that we've seen in all the other movies. I hope we get to see that one at the end of the JJ-verse version of that ship.
Because we've been watching the kind of the TOS version of it with the red Buzzard Ram scoops for collecting hydrogen. You know, we've seen those, so it goes to a square design without the red bits, and then it comes back to it, apparently, in the timelines.
So we'll have to see what happens with that, how they work that in. And, you know, I saw a really cool scene where the Enterprise is going through warp through space, and you get to stand in, and they show ripples of space going around the ship as it's going through warp. It looks like a Star Trek movie to me. And the trailer, it feels like a Star Trek movie to me. I really like the new uniforms. They're very reminiscent of what we saw on TOS as well. They did away with that webbing type fabric that they used in the first two movies. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The uniforms were not blue or yellow or red. They kind of had this little octagon-like fabric pattern on them. And now they've gone more to just a straight color. And if you look close enough, you can see the black collar of some type of a black shirt underneath the uniform, which is very reminiscent of what they wore on TOS. And of course, Uhura's mini skirt as well. So, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of things in this trailer that really feel Star Trek to me. And I'm really looking forward to seeing this movie. I think this movie is going to be a lot better than a lot of fans are thinking and saying that it's going to be, in my opinion. So... it's going to be the 50th anniversary, and I'm really psyched for it. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing this movie. So what is your take on the new trailer?
Did you see on the Wandering In page the little comic strip that I posted with the two nerds looking over the movie trailer?
No.
I've got it posted there, but the one thing that they mention is they're going on over it, and the first line is, "Oh, look, the Enterprise gets destroyed again in the latest Star Trek trailer." And they just start cutting into it where they kept calling it the USS Sean Bean and the USS Whack-A-Mole and USS Red Shirt, and that USS is short form for useless. And that is exactly kind of how I feel. It's, you know, we watched in TOS, we saw the Constitution get eaten by the Doomsday Device. We've seen these things get beaten up, but how many times have we seen the Enterprise get absolutely creamed? Wrath of Khan, but it was still functional. It was still able to do stuff. The girl could still dance after Khan got his nefarious plans in on it. It exploded.
Generations,
but that was after how many seasons of TNG that it finally met its match with the Klingons? And that was just because of
In Nemesis, it got totally obliterated too.
True. Yes, we had that. Yeah, we had. Is there any TV series with the Enterprise E? Am I missing something, or is it just right only in the movies?
Only in the movies.
But I don't know. The Enterprise A / unsuffixed unsuffixed version. It never really met its match in the shows. It was underwhelming. There was times when it went up against things, and like, could you please push this asteroid out of the way, or we'll collide with our planet and we all die? Yeah, we'll try, and its phasers are just too weak, or its shields just can't hold up against this. So they have to resort to diplomacy to get out of things. But in three movies, we've seen this thing get written off for three times now. Because if the trailer's anything, it feels like in the first half hour of the movie we're going to see this thing explode. It's getting destroyed faster and faster now. It's just a flying death trap, and it's not the feel of Star Trek for me.
Well, that Justin Lin, because that came up, there's an article. A lot of this stuff you guys can read on our Facebook page, if you even check out the Facebook page. But Justin Lin said the same thing. It was asked him, why are you destroying the Enterprise again?
Yeah.
Like, three movies, and it's been wasted three times. It's been, and like I said, he said in the interview that the destruction of the Enterprise happens in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And it has to happen in order to lead to bigger and better things. And the only thing I can think of is, you know, at the end of Star Trek IV, that when they get a brand new Enterprise.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking this is the only reason I can think of for them destroying the ship, because they're already in talks for Star Trek IV.
Yeah.
They've already signed the contracts. The movie's not even – Beyond hasn't even been released yet, and they're already in talks for Star Trek IV. Well, they're going to have a ship for Star Trek IV, right?
Yeah. Well, they made a joke about Into Darkness on how it should have ended, where – since, you know, Scotty can teleport people across the galaxy now, that they made the joke there's no need for a space program anymore. The guy's like, here, watch. And he teleports, so he beams away, comes back, and he goes, catch, baby Gorn. And he tosses a baby Gorn at Spock. It's like, I see the trailer where they're going. I can see it because you see Kirk riding around on his motorcycle and you see the dialogue scenes. They're on the planet and they have to do stuff, which that feels like classic Star Trek right there, where it's away missions and they have to physically use their wits and abilities against the enemy. It's not some big techno babble that saves the day. It's the fact that they use humanity's greatest tool, which is themselves and their adaptability and their survivability and their, tactics and stubbornness against a greater foe. I might end up liking it for that reason, but I don't know. Why invest in these ships anymore? The repair bills on the Enterprise alone in this is probably quite astounding.
Well, that was something else that I liked in the trailers. There's a scene where Krall is talking to Uhura, and she says something like, "Well, when our captain comes for us, mercy will be the last thing on his mind." And he looks at her and he says something like, "I hope not," or "I hope I can't wait," or something like that. You know the scene I'm talking about?
Yeah.
He says something like that. And then there's another scene where the flea things destroy the Enterprise, and Uhura says, "We're being boarded." And then you see these—they look like Borg on steroids. These big creatures that are black with green highlights on them, and they come tearing through a hole in the ship, firing their weapons. And I'm like, "Wow, this is stuff we've never seen."
Yeah.
On Star Trek before. I'm looking forward to it. I am really excited for this movie. I really am.
I'm more excited for this than Ghostbusters, but I was more excited to see Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles than Beyond. I'm worried about how this one's going to play out, but that's almost a good thing in a way, because if I don't have high expectations for it, then it doesn't have to live up to those high expectations. So I'll probably end up enjoying it more because I'm not walking in expecting grand, elaborate, video or movie. It's, I don't know what I'm getting when I walk in, and I'll probably like it more once I've seen it and seen what they've come up with.
Well, I wasn't overly... I really don't plan on seeing the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles because I wasn't really impressed with the first one.
You weren't impressed with the first one, you're not going to be impressed with this one. It's better,
in my opinion.
It's better than the first one, but if the first one if you didn't enjoy it, it's not for you.
Yeah, I just didn't. I'm a huge Turtles fan, but those, I didn't consider those the Turtles. They were just too... And the Ghostbusters, I just don't know. It seems to me like it's too much CGI.
Yeah. It feels like the first one. It's the very first Ghostbusters all over again. It's not even a reboot. It feels like, according to the trailers, the perception I'm getting is it's not a reboot. It's a rewrite. Or a redo. It's like, it's not even a reboot of the series. Like, Star Trek 09 was a reboot because it's an entirely different story arc. It's the same ship,
right?
Same character, same characters, different actors, but it's a reboot because the stuff they're doing didn't happen. But if they did Bad Seed all over again, word for word, just different crew, like different actors for it, then it's not even a reboot. It's just a rehash. That, according to the trailers, that's what all I saw is it's kind of the same lines over again, just kind of said in a different way. How many times have we seen ghosts tromping around New York? How many times have we seen them buy the car? They had to buy the car in the first one, and it's like, oh, it's a Cadillac, and it didn't seem new. It's new that it's updated video footage, knew that it's a different cast, but the scripts look too identical for me. My opinion. I'm hoping that movie, when I go see it, blows me away. I hope it does.
I got too many questions. Like, where's the original Ghostbusters? Nobody remembers them?
They're cameos now, apparently.
So, I mean, I don't know. I don't mind CGI if it's used properly. But if it's used in excess, which what I've seen in this trailer for Ghostbusters, it looks like it's in excess, then
yep.
it doesn't become believable anymore. Like I went to see The Thing, the remake of The Thing, which really
yep.
wasn't a remake but more of a prequel. Very well done movie, really good story. I didn't like it because the Thing was too CGI for my taste. The original Thing was all done with puppets and practical effects, and that worked great in the 80s. But when they
yep.
made the new one, it was all done with CGI, and it just wasn't believable enough for me. When I look at it, if I know it's CGI, it pulls me out of the movie.
Exactly. Yep. I hear you right there.
And one of the things that blew my mind, I mean blew my mind, you saw the original Avenger, the first Avengers movie, right?
No, I didn't. Where they're wearing
the
really, really cliche costumes, like the really clunky ones.
Okay, well, when I saw the Avengers, the first Avengers movie, and they're battling in the streets of New York, I was like, wow, this is great. I knew that the aliens and things, you know, were CG, obviously, but they were believable CG. They weren't over-the-top ridiculous. It was like, wow, wow, wow. But what blew my mind, what really blew my mind, is when I was watching the Academy Awards and the Avengers won awards for the best special effects, and I found out that every single sequence of them battling in New York was all CGI, all of it, everything, the entire movie. The only thing that wasn't CGI was Captain America, Black Widow, and Iron Man, and Hawkeye. They were all done on green screens, and everything was CGI. And I was like, oh, my God. When I watched that movie, I completely believed it and bought it that they were in the streets of New York. And that's what good CGI will do for you. It has to be going on, and it has to completely fool you into not even knowing that it's there, and then it's acceptable. But when it's over the top, like I've seen in the Ghostbuster trailers, and your brain knows that what you're looking at doesn't belong there, that's when it pulls you out of the movie.
That's when it ruins it. It's a cheap gimmick at that point.
When you said
the first Avengers, the one that came to mind wasn't the one from this decade. The one that came to mind was Avengers 1978. So I was like,
oh God,
why are we
thinking
that? Like, oh no. That's what I thought, with the really clunky outfits. Like, yeah, the first one, yeah, the CG was brilliant in it. And it was just enough as a zest for the story. It added enhancements. It wasn't the story. It was an add-on to the story that helped it along. When you make the CG the story, it tends to become a problem.
Yes. Yeah, like the Star Wars prequels, you know?
Yeah. Good example right there.
When the CG becomes the story, that's when you have a problem.
Yep. It looks too fake,
so,
and it doesn't last the test of time. I love Angry Video Game Nerd's comment when he said, the CG effects in this look on par with the... was it Bill Murray's Haunted Mansion or Haunted House from Disney?
Yep.
Where the,
yep.
the CG effects are there, but they're not good. They're cartoony and blah. Like, okay, it's Ghostbusters. It's not meant to be taken seriously. I'm fully aware of that. But it's a bit jarring when you see that kind of quality of Scooby-Doo movie kind of CG graphics in a movie alongside live action, you know, actors and sets. It's too jarring. It's too different. You get the effects of like The Good Dinosaur by Pixar, where the backgrounds were gorgeous, but the characters were too cartoony. So it's jolting. It's jarring. It doesn't have a sense of harmony or unity. So again, I'm hoping I go to it and I see it and I love it, because I'm not placing my bets on how bad or good the movie is just based off a couple of trailers. Inside Out taught me 100 times over how not to judge a movie by its trailer. But judging by the trailer, I'm concerned for it. We'll see what the final result is. We'll see when all the cards laid on the table, what we get. But as it stands now, I don't know. It doesn't look like it's going to be all that great, and I don't know.
And the other thing that I heard about the movie, which concerned me, is that they rewrote the Ghostbusters theme song.
Why?
And
why?
They
the
made
Ghostbusters
it...
theme song is so classic. I have it in my car. Every Halloween, I play it. Three of the soundtracks on that CD of 12 are the Ghostbusters theme song.
They have it in, if you watch the trailer, they play it in the trailer, the classic song. But they rewrote it. They hired a rap guy, and they updated it and made it into a rap song. And that really turned me off, too, because if you go to a Ghostbusters movie and you don't hear the song, that's like going to Star Wars and not hearing the Star Wars fanfare. It's a character in the movie.
The first thing I want to see...
So that's got me concerned, too.
When a Star Wars trailer comes on the big screen, first thing I want to hear is, na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Franchise. Like, I go, oh, goody, it's a Star Wars trailer, right? Like, I probably would have been a lot happier if I heard, you know, they did the panning shots in New York. They had the actresses all talking away, and I'm like, what the hell am I watching? And then all of a sudden I hear, who are you going to call? And then they have that heavy bass theme music. I would have probably been hell yes watching that trailer, right? Just building up to that. But music is a character in any production. It's got to be. The music helps you along with the story. It guides you along. It gives you the emotion to the words that the actors are saying. The music is a character in the story. Back to the Future has a memorable theme music, and it's used 100 times over in that movie because it's perfect for every scene. And you know when you hear it, you know it's Back to the Future. You know Star Wars. You know Star Trek with the opening theme music. But Ghostbusters, why did they axe it off? Like, tune it up. Make it, you know, more modern. Yeah, sure, but they completely overhauled it. It could have done really well with it.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. I don't know. I think I've got Ghostbusters. Yeah, I think that's my movie.
Yeah.
I'll have to check.
I think it's going to do quite well in the box office. It's just, I don't know if it's going to be a big screen or Netflix event, you know, like.
Yeah.
I will see it on the big screen. I will be seeing it. I will be giving it a fair chance because it does deserve a fair chance because, again, trailers are like judging a book by its cover. You can have flops as trailers and come out with a really, really darn good movie. But just by what's being presented right now, it's many kinds of nope is what I'm getting as a vibe.
Yeah, I'm just going to have to see it and decide for myself.
Exactly. That's where I'm going to be.
I mean, I'll see it and then I'll make up my mind. Maybe it'll surprise me. Maybe it'll be fun. Maybe the over-the-top CG won't bother me as much as it does in a trailer. Maybe there's a reason for it. I don't know.
Yeah. It is Ghostbusters, after all. It is kind of corny and comedic. It's action-y. And but it's more so a comedy than all else. So having cartoony ghosts and special effects might tie into the theme more than we are expecting it to, because it's definitely not all that serious. In all honesty.
No, no.
So having serious ghosts in it, it would set the tone entirely different than what they're probably trying to go with. So, but again, if that's the tone they're trying to go with, maybe they should have put that tone in the trailer, because the trailers look semi-serious, semi-comedic, right? Like it's...
Right.
Again, it could just be the trailers being a flop, you know, not the movie. So I am withholding my comments on the final production until I see it. And then I will either absolutely love it and say, oh my God, I was wrong. I'm so happy I saw this. Or I'll just be telling people, run away. Run away and never return because it's that bad.
Run, don't walk.
Yeah.
So, anyways, we're out of time for tonight. Can you believe it?
Just that time again, is it?
Wow. So, what's going on around the inn these days?
You know, just video editing away. It's been a bit slow. The work has been offering up plenty of overtime and, you know, dangling it in front of my face, and I see a lot of unboxing videos in my future, so, you know, extra hours are always great, but working six days in a row or 7 days in a row, it's quite exhausting, so most of the time I can't even look at my pile of editing to do because I'm just too burnt out, but next week I'm going on my Midnight's Run, and if everybody follows my Facebook page, they well know that when I go on Midnight's, all of a sudden the floodgates open because I have plenty of time to edit. So, definitely have a lot of Star Trek games on the way, a few, Star Wars coming out, and I've been chipping away kind of at a, comic book idea to work that out. It's in concept phase, so it's going to be a while, a long, long while, but it's working there. It's a work in progress. So yeah, just keeping the fans happy because they're the ones that keep me rolling. So, you know, all the power to them to give me the power to do what they want to see.
And how's 10 Button Gamer doing these days?
He is fantastic. He works on the same production line as me now. So, you know, but on a different shift. I wish it was the same shift because then we can get a lot more done. Him and I are actually trying to plan a movie for the year. Trying to get that out. No, again, no promises. People join in and drop out because life gets in the way. It happens. It's nobody's fault. But it's going to be a prequel to when the Wandering Inn was founded. That's kind of the jive we're going for. It's even a prequel to before his channel even began, the 10 Button Gamer channel on YouTube as well. So it's going to be hopefully good. And because the fans adore the mysterious stranger, he is going to be making an appearance as well in this because, you know, if anybody ever asks anything on the channel about characters, it's always, where's Captain Stew? And what the heck is the mysterious stranger getting into? Because you can't leave that guy unwatched because he'll break everything and he'll have a fun time doing it. So, you know, it's because of those reasons we have that going on. So it's going to be fun. We're still scripting it out. I think we got one of the three acts planned, not scripted. So early phases here, but hopefully we can hash something out before end of summer.
And how about Captain Stew? What's up with Captain Stew?
He's very busy. He's got three channels, I believe, he's working on with the Captain Stew Nothing blog. That's his primary one. He helps out buddies on a couple of other channels as well, being, you know, characters in there, here, there. And then, of course, The Wandering Inn being the fourth channel. He's just made a reappearance on our latest video, which was entertaining, and it gets even better. I can't wait to edit those games because, oh, GMQ makes an appearance, and it is, I'm hoping, absolutely hilarious. So that's coming up. And yeah, so I have several episodes coming out there, and yeah, busy as always. He's got, you know, life is always so very busy.
And how about Vosh? What's going on with him?
Oh, Vax?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's, you know, keeping busy counting his latinum because he made a kit and caboodle. I think the only two people that got happy with the second season of our tabletop game was Vax and Mysterious Stranger because he pretty much now rivals the Grand Negus now in latinum, and, you know, Mysterious Stranger got to blow everything up. So those two made a kit and caboodle. Right now, though, he is on the USS Kepler, you know, just using his skills and abilities of fixing and upgrading and repairing ships to kind of keep the Kepler going, especially when Captain Stew and Captain Clark were kind of out of the picture for a little bit, you know, in the hospital ward, recovering from their Borg fight and mysterious stranger battle. So having him in the engineering department was phenomenal to keep that old derelict ship up and running, you know, full of science officers.
You know, oh, Alpha.
He's a Ferengi, you know, he's always got two fingers in the cookie jar, even though you don't see it. They're there.
That's true. So, listen, we'll have to get a topic ready for our next show. I have no idea what it's going to be, but we'll come up with something. Maybe we'll have Star Trek ship to talk about, maybe.
That would be good. That Mega Cube is coming. I don't think it's going to come soon enough for next week, but that Borg Mega Cube, I'm looking at it, and I see a lot of sad faces on the tabletop when I get it.
Yeah, we'll come up with something, absolutely. And we'll get that posted on the Facebook page as soon as we can come up with an idea or two or three. But in the meantime, we'll talk to you next week, GM Chris. Thanks for spending some time with me tonight. And we'll get together and do this again, same bat time, same bat channel, next Thursday.
Absolutely.
So please check
good.
Out The Wandering In on Facebook. Check out our Facebook page if you want some updates on what's going on. And make sure you like us. If you have any questions, you can message us. We'll get right back to you. And thanks for spending some time with us. Good night, everybody, and good night, GM Chris. I'll see you next week.
Good night, Jim. Glad to be here.
I am Locutus of Borg. Resistance is futile. Your life as it has been is over. From this time forward, you will service